91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, it's Sophie Egan of the Culinary Institute of America. She's written a book about American eating habits and how they characterize food culture. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. Linda Gastenheimer is on assignment today. Sophie Egan is the author of Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. Many Americans spend more time eating at workstations than at home with family. Most everyone says that breakfast is the most important meal, but only 26% have it every day. Have you received text pics of your friends' restaurant meals? And why are so many diners ardently gluten-free when only 1% are intolerant? That's today's Topical Currents. First, the news. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, back. How are you feeling?
I'll try and control my coughing and sneezing.
All right.
Thank you. So, Linda Gassenheimer's away on assignment. She's back next Thursday.
And today we'll discuss food culture with Sophie Egan of the Culinary Institute of America and the author of the book Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are.
There are more than 40,000 items in a supermarket, but what most influences our choices? Why do food fads continue to come and go?
And why do we eat things for what they aren't or don't have rather than what they are?
Sophie Egan joins us now from San Francisco. Welcome to you, Sophie.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. Would you say as a culture, America has always been a sort of fast food culture? I'm thinking we've always been on the run. We've always been hectic. We're not a culture like ancient cultures that relish cooking and eating. You know, it's just not in our culture, is it?
I definitely agree that that is a trait that's been with us from the beginning. One of the most fascinating things I found during the course of my research was a quote from a European traveler visiting the United States in the 1800s who observed how industrious Americans are and how quickly they gorge on food and get on to sort of the producing and the work that is what really matters in their day. And this traveler proposed that our national motto be gobble, gulp, and go.
The three G's.
If only... To which I would say, if only he could see us now.
Yeah, really.
Well, what about people in other developed countries? Do they spend a lot of energy debating dietary issues? I'm thinking of countries with siestas and leisurely lunches and late dinners.
Certainly. So one of the things that really distinguishes us is just how little time we spend focusing on food in the United States. So compared to all the other major developed countries, we spend the least amount of time preparing or cooking food. And in addition, we actually spend the least amount of time eating food. So it's not just that fast food nation sort of eating on the run, but it's that increasingly we outsource the preparation of food to professionals. Few of us sort of during the week, at least, we'll go out of our way to really, prepare something that takes a long time. And weekends are more likely the times that we're going to cook. So these other countries, what I find really interesting is the amount of time that is culturally normal, socially expected to be allocated during your day to food. And a great place to look for that is actually school lunch. In the U.S., kids get as little as 10 minutes a day to scarf down their hot dog, right? How do you expect them to go through life sort of thinking, oh, food matters? You know, that's something we really stop and take a pause and spend time on. So I'm very encouraged by some of these other countries, which definitely are looking at dietary issues. You know, obesity is certainly a global problem, and much of American food culture has been exported. So there's various implications that have come along with that. But I think what's another difference is many of these other countries have national food policies, and we don't have one. That's sort of a broad, you know, what are our values? What are the things that we are saying as a country are important, again, whether it's institutionalized with the amount of time or even just passing on kind of a food literacy from one generation to the next. There's been great articles recently from Michael Pollan sort of calling on this year's political candidates to elevate food at a national level in terms of the priorities that we have in our society.
It's interesting because you say we cook less than other cultures. We prepare less, and if we eat less, yet aren't we one of the most obese nations? Don't we have more obesity than? Go
Correct.
Ahead.
Yeah, we don't eat less. We spend less time eating.
Ah, I
which
see.
Actually, because we're eating, so we actually spend the least amount of time. Just about 30 minutes less than the average across those major developed countries. But as probably many of us know from personal experience, the faster you eat, often the more you eat, right? Because you don't have time to get full.
Right.
So I would attribute, so over time, over the past generation, we have consumed about 400 more calories per day per person. That's an estimate. And we've started to improve a little bit, it appears, but not only do we eat, you know, very rapidly, we eat alone a lot. And eating alone has increased tremendously. The different market research groups are just fascinated how much of this is happening. And that also leads people to sort of do things they might not do in the company of others. Eat a whole kind of share size bag of M&Ms or something because no one's watching, right? Or when you also eat faster when you're by yourself because there aren't those sort of social cues. You know, you look around the table and, okay, is my plate the only one that's empty? Those are very helpful ways of understanding, of keeping a pace. Maybe you're conversing with others. I saw this hilarious new device recently from the Consumer Electronics Show, I think it was. It's called a spoon, S-P-U-N. And it actually beeps at you when you're eating too fast.
Oh, that's interesting.
And what's interesting to me about that is we wouldn't really need something like that if it were more, if more of our meals were in the more social context of a more leisurely pace, conversational pace, and again, where there's sort of more of that social etiquette. So it's fascinating how much eating alone relates to the quantity and speed that you might eat.
Kale.
And the other thing, of course, is just... Kale?
No, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sophie Egan, your book includes the word, the term kale smoothies. I was wondering yes. what one tastes like. I haven't had the pleasure.
Well, most often... So kale smoothies, I think most people who have encountered one, maybe either in the grocery store, there's a variety of different... juice companies that are offering them, but this really to me took off when Starbucks started offering it. And a kale smoothie is sweetened most likely with fruit and other things in the smoothie and yogurt. So I would say it tastes not well. It really depends who's making it, but I can say that at least the ones at Starbucks certainly have a lot of fruit and other things to sort of sweeten it because. It's not necessarily like other fruit smoothies that in terms of taste.
Surely no corn syrup though.
There's in particular, but I would certainly hope not because. Yeah. But it does speak to me this. Kale has been elevated as the latest superfood, of course. We have, acai berries or it's, various spinach, of course, and we look for these foods that we consider, just the things that you can't possibly get enough of. And kale definitely has been having quite a long run, and it doesn't appear to be slowing down in terms of our infatuation, whether it's kale Caesars or kale pesto, and kale smoothies is just one of the many applications of kale in the American diet now.
So what did you find? Why are we so prone to take things to extremes? be it the acai, whatever they're called, acai, acai berries, or the gluten-free, or the omega-3 fatty acids, fish oil, antioxidants, why are we more prone to change our diets with prevailing winds?
Yeah, so this is a really fascinating question, and it drove a lot of my research. What I came to realize is we're very nutrient-centric as a food culture. So we don't look at foods in a very holistic way, sort of whole, fresh foods for, you know, the package that they are. Maybe they're really great choices because they're in season, or they're ripe, or they're grown in ways that we support, or they're taste delicious. You know, you name all those sort of potential reasons. More often, we buy foods for these various. We reduce food to these tallies of grams or nutrients, and when it's things like antioxidants or omega-3s, our brains have this reaction of load up at all costs. And on the flip side, for things like gluten or fat or sodium, it's, you know, banish it, avoid it to, you know, every extreme. And it's really that leads to a huge reliance on food labels to tell us what's healthy, what's sort of safe to put in our baskets and to bring home and ultimately put into our bodies. So we look for those labels as a assurance of that the good things have been kept in and the bad things have been eradicated.
Maybe that's part of the problem, those labels, those FDA labels.
Definitely.
I know they're necessary in some respects, but we just go so overboard. I mean, there was a time that people never read the contents or the ingredients in foods.
Yes, this is a really big issue. And they've been tracking the number of claims and the percentage of new food products that have health or nutrition claim has been on the rise since 2002. And we're just increasingly bombarded. You look at how much of a package is just covered with words. And it's, you know, these food companies know how powerful these are. There's this phenomenon I discovered called health halos, where you think a food as a whole, all of us react in this way, where we see fat-free and we think the food is higher quality. We think it's lower in calories, which it usually is about
right.
The same. And we actually will then eat more of it. And this happens with other labels like non-GMO and gluten-free and so on. And I think that it's definitely, these claims, there's a lot of backlash starting, I would say, because people feel so overwhelmed just by the amount of, you know, reading that is involved in sort of picking a single item. It leads to decision fatigue in the aisles.
Right.
So natural is a great example where this has been slapped on, you know, natural and all natural has been slapped on all manner of products. And now finally the FDA put out for public comment the opportunity to say, well, how do we define natural? Because it seems like all kinds of things are putting natural on their label. So that comment period actually just ended on May 10th, and we'll see where that leads in terms of putting some real criteria behind some of these claims that right now are often unfounded and definitely lead us to either overreact to think that they're really much better than they might be, and at the same time actually overlook the parts that maybe the company is not mentioning. For
right.
example, many cereals that say made with whole grain are loaded with sugar and other things that you don't want to eat.
Well,
you know,
and
Fruit Loops is one of my favorite examples of that. It's over half sugar by weight and has, you know, artificial colors and so on. But the part that they tout is the made with whole grain.
Right. We're speaking with Sophie Egan. She's a food author and director of programs in culinary nutrition at the Culinary Institute of America. She's written Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. I'm going to take a short break, and we'll be right back and take your calls. Well, Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and we resume our conversation with Sophie Egan, who's written Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. If you'd like to join in the conversation, do you consider yourself a conscious eater, or do you generally scarf down your meals without thinking? Maybe you follow the latest food fads, be they diets or foods. And when was the last time you went out to lunch and didn't eat at your desk? Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or
email radio@wlrn.org if you'd like to get in perhaps a little quicker. Sophie Egan, a part of your book that's very entertaining concerns the development of Taco Bell's Dorito Locos Taco. And it's unbelievable how much thought and psychology is involved in these ever-changing fast food menus.
Oh, absolutely. This yes, I had the pleasure of actually visiting Taco Bell headquarters and meeting with their food scientists, the geniuses behind the Doritos Locos Taco, or DLT as it's been called. And that little taco has been hailed as the taco that saved America because it's created 15,000 additional jobs just with the increased demand for this this beef taco that is has a hard shell of a bright neon Dorito. And we actually, as a country, 800 million of these in 10 weeks. So it was broke all kinds of records, and it actually is one of the all-time best-selling fast food items of all time.
Have you tried
really,
it?
Really, as you said.
Did you try
yes,
it?
I have.
Neither Bonnie or I have, but what does it
yes,
taste like?
Yes, I you know, it's, well, so one of the things that they really spent a lot of time, the food scientists, in mastering was what they call one of the brand equities of Doritos, which is that cheesy residue that shows up on your fingers long
finger,
after you
finger staining good.
Yes, exactly. And that actually led to, it was an increased difficulty to really nail that same attribute. So what's funny, when you eat the DLT, is they created this little taco holster, a little kind of paper case, and that was mostly, you know, for so that the orange goo wouldn't get all over everything else in their operation at a given Taco Bell. But the real benefit to consumers has been that eating a DLT is actually very messy. It breaks, it gets all over the place, and so they thought it was really funny that people eating the DLT would say, "Thank you, Taco Bell, for providing a bib." It's this little kind of catch tray for how much it breaks. But in any case, it really is fascinating, all the R&D that goes into these, what I call stunt foods. And they are these novel concoctions coming out of primarily fast food chains. Often they're pegged as limited time only. You know, they're offered for special occasion. You might think of the McRib, or we've seen KFC's Double Down sandwich, where there was a sandwich made out of
two chicken breasts
instead of the buns. We had bacon sundaes at Burger King, pizza that's wrapped in all kinds of things, bacon, hamburger.
But you know what,
hot dogs.
Sophie? You know what I find interesting? It's almost contradictory, because on the one hand, you say as Americans, we like to be individual about what we eat. We like to customize everything, and that's why Starbucks has whatever it was, 87,000 drink combinations. We want everything mm-hmm. to our exact specifications. On the other hand, you're saying we flock like sheep to these food fads. So it's interesting, because it really does Wait, you cut out a bit. You cut out a bit.
There we go.
Oh, I'm sorry. Definitely one of the biggest themes, one of the biggest takeaways about who we are as eaters in America is we are full of contradictions. So you're definitely hitting a great point. We, in general, want to personalize and customize, and I don't look at the popularity of stunt food so much as a sheep mentality, but actually as a very powerful, smart combination of marketing techniques.
Right.
So those are, in particular, Taco Bell, when it came out with that Doritos Locos Taco, the tagline was Live Moss. It was this idea that actually in the psychology literature is really fascinating. It's this concept of an experiential resume. So the same way that in our lives we sort of aim to accumulate and collect job experiences, we aim to collect life experiences, that bucket list idea. And going out and eating a DLT is as much about showing that productivity side of American values, the work ethic, the having a lot to show for your time on Earth or in a given day. It's like, yeah, I lived a full life. I ate a Doritos Locos Taco. And that is one powerful marketing technique. And the other is this this false scarcity in the marketplace. This happens with seasonal foods and the limited time only that I mentioned, where it gives you this sense of hurry and frenzy that if you don't act now, you'll miss. It's FOMO, fear of missing out, right? So I look at it much more that it's that we as individuals have things we value and are looking for in our food choices. But as with all those health claims that were being bombarded, we are very much shaped by the powerful, not only cultural, but physical environment of the food landscape around us. And that absolutely includes all of the different marketing techniques that are going on.
Sophie Egan, how about a word or two about your personal dietary habits? I read in the book, now this sounds very, very decadent, that you allow yourself to eat one chewy chocolate chip cookie a week. How could you?
I know, yes. Well, one of the things that I really did try to emphasize in the book, and this is not by any means a book about what you should eat or what you shouldn't eat or, you know, calling out winners and losers. It's much more an investigation or holding a mirror up to our eating habits and why we eat what we eat. But with regard to my own habits, I feel a lot of the same issues that I think anyone out there does in terms of time constraints. You know, I don't cook nearly as much as I'd like to. In terms of work, you know, working all the time, and the other different elements of customization. I'm certainly a big fan of personalizing my order as well. But with regard to my eating habits, I think the main thing I can say is I have never been a proponent or an adherent, I should say, of any diet. And the main advice in general in life is to develop a healthy eating pattern. And that means something that can be sustainable. So when I mentioned the example about the cookie, you know, I've had this realization over time, and I think most people who've tried diets, that if you the more that you sort of deprive and restrict, these cravings build up over time. So for me, I don't eat a lot of dessert. I certainly don't eat, you know, a cookie every day, or I don't eat dessert after lunch and after dinner, anything like that. But yeah, allowing myself a treat once a week definitely feels like something I can sustain and maintain. And
we'll let you have that, Sophie.
Okay, let's take a call or two. We have Ed in Fort Lauderdale. Ed, you're up. Hi.
Hi, everyone. This is a fantastic conversation. Thank you for discussing this today.
Oh, thanks for joining us, Ed. Go ahead.
Appreciate it. So I had a question about your labeling comment. You had said that, you know, there's a lot of issue around certain products being labeled low fat, low calorie diet, whatever, that are drawing the attention of multiple people. I'd like to see if you could like elaborate a little bit more on the difference between what might be FDA recommended or just plain marketing, and how that plays into it, and what's being done to affect you know, the negative marketing that drives some of these negative eating habits in our day to day. And I'll take my call off the air.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you so much, Ed, for the question. So the main thing to know is that there's a difference between front of package labeling and the nutrition facts panel and ingredients list. So the front of any given package is where the companies have a lot more leeway. So for example, on the front, it can say made with whole grain. There's actually very little standardized requirements for what that means. Multigrain also does not mean anything in terms of whole grain content. However, 100% whole grain has a much more clearly defined definition. So there's a lot of different examples like that, as with natural, where the FDA has actually kind of left it a little bit vague as far as what a food product, what criteria might need to meet. So the area that consumers can actually be a bit more empowered is by looking at the ingredients list, and that's on the back of the product. And think about why this might be, right? When you're grazing items in the grocery store, many people only look at the front. So that is, and often the lettering is much bigger than the tiny little small print of the ingredients list. There's currently some rules changes that are happening. Maybe you've read about this, where they're going to add an added sugars component to the nutrition facts panel and also changing some of the font to make it a little bit easier to read. But just with the whole grains example, the best bet is actually to look at the ingredients list. And if a whole grain or whole wheat flour is not the first ingredient, then it's not likely a product that has a substantial amount of whole grain in it. So you can sort of put aside whatever claim it has. There are examples. Another one would be that actually a product can say zero trans fat, but have as much as 0.5 grams per serving of trans
saturated
fat in it.
Or
actually.
Saturated fat, right?
Yes. So then the trick there is to look at the ingredients list for partially hydrogenated oil, and you would want to make sure that that's not in the ingredients list. So there are these ways where you have to sort of be I think this is unfair personally, but the onus is on consumers to have those that information about what they really need to look for. But in general, I would say that the ingredients lists and nutrition facts panels are because they're so much more regulated and they're more transparent, those tend to be safer bets. But it's a very, very difficult environment for us to be making food choices in, and I certainly wish there was a little bit more onus on food companies in terms of what they can and can't be putting on their products.
Right. We're speaking with Sophie Egan, food author and director of programs and culinary nutrition at the Culinary Institute of America. She's written Devoured, and we're going to take another break. We'll be back. Our number, 1-800-743-9576.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Linda Gassenheimer is on assignment today. Instead, we're speaking with Sophie Egan of the Culinary Institute of America. We're talking about her great new book, Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are.
And if you'd like to join in the conversation, our number is 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. Do you know what drives your food choices, or are they mostly just unconscious or due to time constraints, a function of time constraints? 1-800-743-9576.
And Sophie, I was wondering if you could explain something you wrote about in the book quite a bit. This was this terrible, almost apocalypse that we almost encountered before the Super Bowl, when Velveeta made a fake claim that there was a shortage of Velveeta and people better stock up to make sure they had nachos at the Super Bowl.
Yes. So this was called Cheesepocalypse. By Kraft Foods, there was a whole website about how to navigate and survive the cheesepocalypse, which was, as you can imagine, a marketing stunt. And what they said was that in advance of the Super Bowl, we're very sorry to report, but we are out of Velveeta. I don't know how Super Bowl parties will go on. And what it turned out was that there was a shortage of the 1 pound boxes or containers of Velveeta, and actually most people buy the 2 pounds, which is interesting to learn. But the bigger reason that this was actually what I call a false alarm was that Velveeta is actually not one of the foods that most people eat on Super Bowl Sunday more compared with other, you know, regular Sundays. So there's this fascinating concept called high indexing, and that's what firms such as NPD Group, who track our eating behaviors, that's a term they use to compare the spikes in different food purchases. And actually, the foods that spike the most, that are the highest indexers, so the foods that we most need to have for the Super Bowl, Velveeta is not one of them. So there were a variety of reasons that that was creating a lot of hullabaloo for no good reason. And this is a kind of a pattern that's emerged over many years of Super Bowls, whether it was avocados or chicken wings. And those are things that we do actually eat with the Super Bowl, but the shortages were turned out with some rather interesting investigation to be not something to worry about. But it really gets us out stocking up and buying these things out of fear that they won't be available.
Hoarding Velveeta.
So, hoarding, exactly.
Sophie, I don't know about you, but the next thing, which I really think goes back to the same thing, that we're a busy culture, and at best, you know, you talk about how we usually eat at our desks. Well, I don't know. I mean, in Europe, you know, they close the stores, they have that long siesta. Who do you know that can go out to lunch? I mean, even in the 50s, those martini lunches that, you know, the advertising executives would take. But at worst, we don't even eat, or we eat while we're walking. Desk is a good thing.
Yes, no, definitely. I know many people who, you know, 40% of Americans feel don't eat breakfast because they feel they don't have time. And I definitely know many people who don't have a chance to eat lunch because it's one meeting after the next, and it's sort of just this conveyor belt that you're swept across throughout your busy day. So if you even have a chance, as you said, to kind of scarf down a sandwich, you might be lucky. Really what it says to me is it's so much about what is set up as the culture in your workplace. So I describe that this phenomenon at large of sad desk lunch, which many of us have probably been there, you know, eating at our keyboards. This is across the U.S. and in a variety of sectors and types of offices. But when I, to your question of who do I know, what I see is that there are, every office and every company has its own work culture. And that is very much set sort of top down of what does the boss do? What has been established as this is what we do here. So I actually have seen some really interesting companies that make it the office norm to take a break and eat lunch together. Some employers might provide that lunch, and you know, at Good Eggs, they had that's a company here in San Francisco. They had, you know, they ring out like a cowbell, and it's like lunch is served. And everyone takes a break and goes and eats together.
All right.
Not a WLRN yet.
No, we don't have that yet.
It's so much about, though, what I was saying earlier, which is that individual food choices are shaped by the environment around us. So if your neighbor eats at your desk and you eat your desk and your desk neighbor, and all of the colleagues around you eat at your desk, then that's normal. And that reinforces to you that you do that. And then you doing that reinforces to them that that's the normal thing to do. So to really change social norms, it has to come from this kind of power in numbers idea. I do not expect that in the midst of an environment where everyone eats at their desks, that individuals will say, I'm going out for lunch for an hour. Have a nice,
yeah, right.
You know, hope, yeah, enjoy. That's very difficult to do. And we shouldn't expect that. But to sort of get towards a place where we can culturally focus on food more, take that mental break, eat slower, eat more mindfully, it has to be made at the institutional level of
right.
This is something that we think is important and we're making it normal.
And we'll go to another listener call. This is Scott in Pembroke Pines. Scott, hi.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, great, that's good. All right, yeah, it's real interesting, you know, what the guest is saying and from what approach he's coming at it. But what is her opinions on the plant-based vegan, you know, whole foods plant-based movement?
Sophie, can you hear the question?
Yeah, I think the question is, what's my take on plant-based eating?
Yeah, vegan eating.
Yes. Yeah, so I actually would say that that the question I would challenge a little bit, which is that I think plant-based and vegan should not have to mean the same thing.
Okay.
And so I'm actually very encouraged by the direction that is gaining more or is becoming more mainstream, which is just that we're celebrating vegetables and sort of vegetable-centric eating in ways we didn't before. Same with, you know, plant proteins. Maybe it's chickpeas or lentils. You know, this year is the International Year of the Pulse. I don't know if anyone...
Of the what?
Are the family... Pulses. That's the family of legumes and lentils and all those other plant proteins. This is the UN's International Year of that food category. So in any case, I find it very encouraging the way that as the very meat-centric culture that we have been historically in the United States, that we're starting to get a little bit more excited by these other, by plant proteins, so nuts, lentils, et cetera, that I mentioned, chickpeas, quinoa, and so on, roasted vegetables and cauliflower. But and I think a lot of that is coming through the flavor experiences, the exotic cuisines of other cultures, other countries that maybe you eat it out of a food truck, or maybe it's a prepared food at your, you know, I think the caller mentioned Whole Foods, that kind of introduce you to, oh, wow, I do like hummus, you know, or, oh, wow, I do like, you know, whatever it might be. But in terms of veganism, that's still, that can turn a lot of people off because it's so binary. So I generally am more excited about these eating patterns, so focusing more on plants, not saying you have to remove all, for people who are vegan, that's terrific for them. But on a more mainstream level, I think we'll have a better chance of people moving in that direction if it's something that allows for more flexibility and it's just a little bit reversing the ratios so that you're not eating meat, say, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Right.
And you're just eating a little bit more plants compared to what you did before.
We're speaking with Sophie Egan. She's written Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. And our last break, we'll be right back.
It is today's Topical Currents, Thursday edition. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. We continue our conversation about food culture with Sophie Egan. She's the author of the book Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How What We Eat Defines Who We Are. We have a few lines open. If you'd like to join in, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Sophie, something in your book you talked about was the geographic pockets across America of various food likes. Could you espouse that? Talk about that a little bit.
Certainly. So within the U.S., we have a variety of regional cuisines, and I really observed that people tend to identify more with the eating habits of their region. So, you know, maybe it's barbecue in the South, or it's, you know, Tex-Mex, or in California here, everyone loves to talk about how much, you know, do we just have this bread basket of endless, wonderful, fresh produce, and that guides a lot of the types of salads in California cuisine that we might eat. But I really, in my book, set out to find out actually what are the common threads across the country, whether you're in Miami or California or Tuscaloosa or Chicago or Seattle or wherever. And that was what was really fascinating and really fun about doing this book, was to find out those core values as Americans that unite us. But certainly the different regional cuisines are among the most fun aspects of being an American, is that you can travel just to the neighboring state or just a couple hours away. And the U.S. is so big and so diverse that it's like going to a whole new country sometimes in terms of the different foods you would experience.
Barbecue is very big in Brooklyn.
In Brooklyn?
Yeah, so it's a really hotbed of barbecue now.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, no, I haven't had barbecue in Brooklyn. I've eaten many bagels in Brooklyn, I can tell you.
Exactly. I think it's interesting because we're such a melting pot, you know, and so it is like we're so many countries at the same time. And we're relatively young and, you know, everybody comes from around the world and settles here. So we have no, it's not like we're known for our pasta or we're known for our baking.
Yes, absolutely. And
cake? Come on.
Yeah, right.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, well, it's interesting. Yes, it's really interesting. What is American food, quote unquote, right? Because you're right. It changes all the time. And we don't have these really long-standing food traditions the way that they might have in other countries. But I argue that it's one of the best things about being an eater in the U.S. It's sort of the double-edged sword of our appreciation for innovation and novelty is that we're really open-minded, generally speaking. You know, we will throw it all into the mix with regard to different immigrant cuisines and kind of fold them into this melting pot cuisine that over time has become defined as American. And I think it's really interesting to observe the way the waves of immigrants over our history and how they've shaped our foods because of the fact that, you know, Germans and British immigrants were among the first to come over. Our traditional American palate has been something that basically the food groups are pretty much all white or beige. You know, you have your sort of became known for meat and potatoes, and that kind of goes back to those type of roots. But then as Italians came over, late 1800s, early 1900s, today you could not define American food without pasta and pizza and so on. And this is happening with cuisines from all over the globe. I mean, think about how much today, you know, sushi or Korean tacos or, you know, naan. I mean, these are things that are household items that we really cannot even imagine being eaters in America without them now. So I think it's just one of the greatest aspects of our culture that should be celebrated, as opposed to the sometimes common lamenting about the idea of fusion, because you're compromising the authenticity of where it came originally. But it's so much a part of our identity in the U.S. to sort of mix it all together.
Right, exactly.
And next up we have Todd. Todd's in Del Rey. Hi. Hello, Todd.
Hi, Todd.
Yeah.
Hello?
You need to turn your radio down, Todd.
Sorry. I just wanted to share that there's a great book called The Yoga Discipline, and in that book is two chapters on eating. So this book isn't about meditation or hatha yoga. It's about being very conscious on how you eat and how to... It's yoga from the perspective of yoga essentially is to build energy, to build strength, to build a sense of well-being. So the chapters on eating go into great detail on that.
Sophie, are you familiar with the book?
No, I'm not familiar with that book, but that's a really great point that the caller brings up, which is sort of the, gaining energy from food and people... with kind of self-diagnosis or self-experimentation, I'm sure we've all seen that we react in different ways to different foods. So you kind of have the sugar crash after eating a lot of refined carbs, right? Maybe after eating fresh, whole, healthier foods, you might have more energy and sustained over the day. But I think the main thing I would take from sort of the ethos of yoga is really about mindfulness, and it's about being present in the moment with the, you know, certainly with yoga, with your body movements and things like that. But with eating, we really don't savor as much as we might benefit from. And what I mean by that is often multitask. It's not just the eating desk at your lunch or eating lunch at your desk, but most of us are probably have been the eating with one hand, scrolling through your smartphone with the other hand. Right? 40% of Americans or of smartphone users actually enjoy eating alone so that they can watch TV or catch up on social media or what have you. But it just makes for a much less intentional and mindful eating experience. So I think I'd be curious to check out that book and hear what is recommended. But I certainly advocate for just the very simple tenet of mindfulness, which is sort of when you eat, just eat. You know, think about the five senses, slow down, be present mentally with the food that you're experiencing, and you'll get a lot more out of it.
Sophie, you talk about us being a grazing culture, and we're always hearing it's better to eat several small meals rather than those three ceremonious meals. It's better for our metabolism. Mm-hmm. It's better for our blood sugar. But you mm-hmm. say we're eating meals in addition to grazing. Is that it?
Yes, exactly. This is one of the most stunning things is how much snacking we're doing actually in the U.S. Over half of Americans snack 2 to 3 times per day, and many people are eating every 2 hours. And what's the difference really is between principle and practice. So, yes, in principle, eating a few small meals throughout the day may be better for sort of maintaining even blood sugar levels. I don't think anyone feels great after the gut bomb experience, right, of kind of overeating a huge amount after going a really long period where you're just starving. But in practice, most people are just adding snacks to what they would have eaten anyways. So it's more that the floodgates have been opened socially, that it's now, you know, before there sort of used to be places you ate and places you didn't eat and times you ate and times you didn't eat. And all the lines are blurred today. And it's really this sort of social experiment where we don't really know how it's all going to unfold. And we haven't really worked out that etiquette. You know, if you eat in, I see people in, shopping at like a shoe store eating snacks. You have beef jerky in your purse and you're at the sidelines of your kid's soccer game or you're in a meeting. What meeting now doesn't have food, at least the meetings that I've seen. And I think that what remains to be seen is right now it appears we're eating more total than we used to. But it's sort of the same way that the presence of technology in our lives, smartphones in particular, outpaced the etiquette. And I think the same thing is happening with snacks, where they have risen in terms of the prominence and acceptance, but we don't yet have quite the rules all worked out of how to make that a healthy lifestyle choice.
So if you have your way, you just want people to become more aware of their eating choices, would you say?
Absolutely. Yes, my real intention with writing this book is to give people a bird's eye perspective on themselves. And it's not only, it's to sort of stop with a lot of what I see with a lot of guilt and blame game of individuals, you know, we don't cook because we're lazy or, we're a fast food nation because we don't care about where food comes from. We just want to, you know, care about convenience.
Right.
And I'm asking us to take a step back and say, well, what's driving these food choices? And so I do hope that it's armed with that bird's eye perspective, as I say, that greater awareness that people can start to gain more control over their food choices and at least be having these more intentional, purposeful daily relationships to food.
Well, thank you, Sophie Egan. She's a food author, director of programs in culinary nutrition at the Culinary Institute of America, also a contributor to the New York Times Well blog. Her book is Devoured, From Chicken Wings to Kale Smoothies, How We Eat What We Eat Defines Who We Are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure.
And thanks for joining us this hour. Today's program was produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Polly Landis is associate producer. Linda Gassenheimer returns next week. And we have audio archives of all our programs at the website, WLRN.org. And there's more information, links, and pictures at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ira Flatow and Science Friday. Bonnie and I return Monday with an author interview, philosophy professor Michael Patrick Lynch, about his book, The Internet of Us. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.